it's pretty simple stuff in terms of transparency and access to your own records.
Alaska's senators get behind the pilot's Bill of Rights. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 7th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, studying a marine mammal with a healthy appetite.
It's kind of like watching a Tasmanian devil eat.
A cute Tasmanian devil. Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska's senators are backing what's being called a pilot's Bill of Rights. The legislation proposed by Oklahoma Senator and pilot Jim Inhofe aims to grant aviators more access to information and clarifies Federal Aviation Administration rules. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Under the proposed Pilot's Bill of Rights, if there's a claim that a pilot broke the rules, the FAA would have to turn over all evidence to him or her 30 days before giving any punishment. That information would include air traffic communication tapes. Senator Inhofe says that's not currently done, and it leaves pilots unprepared to defend themselves. Senator Lisa Murkowski says pilots deserve access to the personal information held by the FAA or the National Transportation Safety Board.
Issues within the NTSB not being able to gain access to your files or to your records, it's pretty simple stuff in terms of transparency and access to your own records.
Murkowski says Alaskan pilots have contacted her with complaints that the current system just doesn't grant them enough information.
It was interesting hearing some of the stories that were told about situations where there had been an incident and a pilot was given either a reprimand or license pulled and no clear understanding as to the reasoning behind it or what he or she may have to do in order to get it back.
Senator Inhofe had a run-in with FAA rules last year when he landed on a closed Texas runway. In the senator's case, he had to take a remedial training program, but the FAA didn't take legal action against him. Afterward, he pledged to introduce legislation relating to his experience. The bill he's proposed also calls for a review of the FAA's medical certification process and forms. Senator Inhofe says there are too many cases when pilots misinterpret the paperwork and are then accused of intentionally falsifying them. The issue of pilot medical exams and records is controversial. In May, the NTSB found in an investigation into the plane crash that killed former Senator Ted Stevens and four others last summer that the pilot did not go through rigorous enough medical screening after suffering a stroke. The Inhofe bill does not call for a loosening of medical qualifications, just a review of the process. The so-called Pilot's Bill of Rights has two dozen co-sponsors in the Senate. Congressman Don Young's office says a companion bill is expected to be introduced in the House soon, which he plans to support. Meanwhile, Alaska's senators are also pushing for more privacy in the skies. They signed a letter sent last week to Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, pushing him to keep what's called the BAR program, or the Block Aircraft Registration Request Program. It allows plane operators to have their aircraft tail number withheld from real-time flight tracking software. Secretary LaHood is calling for the program to be dismantled, saying that only operators with a verified security threat could keep their flight path private. But Senator Mark Begich says releasing the tail numbers and flying routes makes public too much information.
Let's say you have two companies that are talking about merging. Lots of times they're flying on their private jets back and forth to corporate headquarters. And here's what can happen. You can start having speculators who now know where these guys are going. Or let's say there's a company in Alaska that's an oil company, has prospects that they're developing, and they are now talking to other oil and gas partners that could have dramatic positive impact to our state. but they want to keep it private while they're trying to figure out all the financial arrangements that are going on.
Begich says people in the public eye should also be able to remain anonymous when they travel, whether they're witnesses in a court case or millionaires concerned about kidnapping threats. Begich co-authored the letter as co-chairman of the Senate General Aviation Caucus. Besides Murkowski, 23 other senators also signed on. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
State legislators have largely been enthusiastic about a report they asked for that indicates it would be possible for the state to finance a so-called bullet line to deliver North Slope natural gas to the interior and south central parts of the state, where gas wells are playing out. But State Senator Tom Wagoner of Kenai points to growing signs of renewed industry interest in Cook Inlet and urges caution. He's concerned about discouraging the investment climate. Wagoner is the author of a tax credit bill that is designed to pay for the first wells drilled from a jackup rig capable of reaching the deeper waters of Cook Inlet. Two companies are actively preparing to bring rigs to the state. APRN's Steve Heimel has an update.
The names are Pioneer, Apache, Escapeda, Cook Inlet Energy, and Buccaneer. Escapeda is the company that now has a jackup rig in Canadian waters awaiting Jones Act clearance, or more likely some sort of fine, from the Division of Customs and Border Protection. Company spokesman Steve Sutherland says he expects word on that within a few days. Escapeda is a Texas company with lease holdings in the central part of the inlet, the Kitchen Lights Complex, and on the west side near the existing Beluga gas field. The Spartan 151 is small as offshore rigs go, but can drill in waters as deep as 150 feet. Escapeda is after oil primarily because the Cook Inlet gas market is too small to provide much of an incentive. Apache Energy says it too is after oil, but it is actively promoting gas internationally and was the dominating bidder in last month's state lease sale in the inlet. It has leases right next to Escapeda's. Then there's Buccaneer. That's an Australian company partnered with a Singapore firm and the state of Alaska to bring a bigger jackup rig to the inlet. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority has made a $30 million deal for an ownership share of that rig.
Rig and it can drill and operate in waters up to 300 feet deep and with a drilling depth of 25,000 feet.
According to ADA spokesman Karsten Rodvik, Buccaneer's rig can operate in waters twice as deep as Escapeda's. Buccaneer already has a track record in the area with a new producing natural gas well almost in the town of Kenai. The company plans to drill up to 10 wells there and build a pipeline to whoever will buy that gas. Buccaneer's offshore prospect is over toward the west side of Cook Inlet and to the north of Escapeda's. The Buccaneer offshore rig is called the Adriatic II. It is currently in Malaysia, will be refitted in Singapore, and probably transported this year to the inlet. It is unlikely to be here in time to drill before ice sets in the inlet, and it's not clear yet where it would be stored. Meanwhile, a whopping $67 million in state tax credits awaits the first company to drill three holes in the inlet with a jackup rig. If Escapeda manages to get the Spartan 151 across the border, it will get the prize. Company spokesman Steve Sutherland says he does expect the company's costs to well exceed the amount of the credits. Is Buccaneer hoping to be in that race? ADA's Karsten Rodvik says it was something that played no part in the authorities' negotiations with the company.
Our deal with Buccaneer is not dependent on the state tax incentives. We believe that there is going to be sufficient work to gainfully employ both rigs, perhaps for a considerable period of time.
Meanwhile, oil production has resumed at the dormant Osprey offshore platform on the west side. Cook Inlet Energy, owned by a Tennessee company, plans to drill more wells there to increase production. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state works to reduce veterans' unemployment numbers.
The most important thing a returning veteran could do is to file for all the benefits that the VA has to offer them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Add sea otters to the list of critters transmitting radio signals in southeast Alaska. Researchers recently captured and tagged the marine mammals north of Petersburg. It's part of a project studying the habits and rapid spread of otters, which were reintroduced to the region a little more than 40 years ago. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Whenever you are.
Catching sea otters isn't necessarily easy, and when you do, they let their feelings be known.
I think a lot of times people think that they're cute, cuddly, small little creatures. They are cute, but they're not cuddly, and they are not small.
That's Verena Gill, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist. She's part of a cooperative research effort that captured and tagged 30 sea otters near Cake. They ranged from babies to a male weighing more than 100 pounds. Scientists and others implanted VHF radios so they can track movement and monitor behavior. They also sampled bodily fluids and whiskers to check for viruses and learn more about diet. She says the studies can help track environmental issues.
Otters are a really good canary in a coal mine, so to speak. They're a really good indicator of what's happening in the nearshore marine ecosystem. They inhabit the same area that we do. They eat many of the same subsistence foods that we do. They're impacted by runoff from terrestrial environments. And so they are really sort of like a first warning system as to what is going on.
The CAPTURE program is one of several coordinated sea otter research projects going on in the region. Another will determine their numbers in northern southeast, following a similar count in the south. A third effort is monitoring feeding behavior from shore. Zach Hoyt of the University of Alaska School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences is part of that project.
They're voracious predators, yeah. They have the ability to consume 25% of their body weight a day in invertebrates. They have a very, very high metabolism because they're the only marine mammal that doesn't have blubber. So they have to fuel themselves, and they do that through consuming energy.
That energy comes from eating large amounts of crab, sea urchins, shrimp, clams, and sea cucumbers.
It's kind of like watching a Tasmanian devil eat.
Sunny Rice works with the Petersburg office of the university's Marine Advisory Program. She says research on otter numbers and feeding habits will help crabbers and dive fishermen anticipate future impacts.
As otters were moving into new areas that they traditionally fished, they were not seeing any more of that resource.
The fur trade virtually wiped out southeast Alaska sea otters by the early 1900s. The state reintroduced the mammals in the 1960s. Recent population growth in the southern part of the region has been 13% a year. Hoyt, the university researcher, says that's not as surprising as it seems.
Right now, I would say that the population is definitely growing exponentially, which is typical of a species that isn't resource limited.
The sampling part of the CAPTURE project will also help define otter diet. Wildlife biologist Gill says whiskers can show what's been consumed during the past year.
And the really exciting thing about that is we had a series of whiskers spanning the last 20 years from animals that had been harvested by native people in the area. And we had those analyzed, and we'll be able to compare the diet from 20 years ago to the contemporary animals that we captured here in May.
Federal protections limit otter harvests to Alaska natives. Pelts can only be sold to the general public if they've been significantly modified. Researchers are asking hunters to avoid taking tagged otters, but they're also interested in information about any carcasses, which could become part of the scientific database. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The U.S. Congress's Joint Economic Committee has released updated statistics on veterans' unemployment numbers since 9/11/2001. Committee Chairman Senator Bob Casey says the high unemployment rate among the nation's nearly 2.5 million veterans who have served since then is unacceptable. Alaska's overall unemployment rate as of May is 7.4%, but the number is higher for vets. I spoke with Verdi Bowen, who is the Director of Veterans Affairs for the state of Alaska, about what kind of a job market Alaska's vets can expect when they are discharged.
Our veterans actually in the state of Alaska are employed a lot better than the lower 48 states. Our veterans in Alaska are running at 8.1% unemployment. The overall population for veterans is at 14.8%, which is a lot higher than the standard rate. And in some places that you go to, in certain areas of the country, it climbs into the 20 percentile range. And a lot of those areas are hit with factory closures or factory turndowns. And we do have, right now, currently, we have a lot of veterans calling Alaska looking to see what kind of workplace or work programs that we have to put veterans in to help them be employed, probably driven because of the fact that our unemployment rate is lower.
Could you outline for me some of the programs that veterans can take advantage of?
Well, here in Alaska, we have the Alaska Job Center Network, which is throughout the state. And specifically, they have areas set up for veterans in Anchorage, Eagle River, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, Wasilla. And what they are is that they help them do priority job referrals within either federal government jobs or state jobs. They provide career counseling at the job centers. They do career assessments. Sometimes a veteran will come in and might need some testing or something to qualify for a job, and they will help them with that. They have some special programs for special need veterans, because sometimes we have veterans that have handicaps.
In general, what would you suggest to, like, the most important thing a returning veteran could do?
The most important thing a returning veteran could do, even prior to hitting the job market if they're returning and they're being released from active duty, is to file for all the benefits that the VA has to offer them. Currently, right now, our veterans returning from combat have the post-9/11 GI Bill, and is probably one of the best education programs since World War II. It allows them to go to school, and if they go to, say, the University of Alaska, it'll pay 100% of their tuition fees and books, and it'll also provide them a monthly stipend. In the Anchorage area, it's $1,900 a month, and they will be able to train in any areas that they would like to, as long as it falls in line with the VA-certified programs. Also, along with that, is if they were injured while they were either in combat or in the service, they also qualify for something called vocational rehabilitation. And what that is that's an outstanding education program that the VA has, and it takes into account their disabilities and tries to match them up into a job that will allow them to sustain a fairly decent quality of life.
Given the high technology of our military, wouldn't you think that many a veteran would have a technical knowledge that would be valuable in the marketplace?
In today's world, even your infantryman has to go through massive amounts of computer skill training, map reading, GPS. If you go through the list of things, most of them have attained at least 20 to 21 college credits within their first 4 years of service. And it's done through all of these education programs. And most of these skill sets do transfer to the civilian workforce.
Are there any incentives given to employers that would urge them to hire veterans?
Yes, there is. We do have some incentives. And the way that's done, it's done through the like helmets to hard hats. It's usually in the trades program plus, I want to say, student program, because it helps the military person transition into the commercial sector through the trades program, and it pays them an extra stipend from their GI Bill to allow them to pursue that education track. The best one that I know of off the top of my head is Troops to Cops. That is an outstanding program to get people into the local law enforcement.
How about our rural Alaska veterans? There's quite a few Alaska Natives who serve. They come from areas where there were no jobs to begin with. So is there any kind of outreach to those remote areas?
Yes, there is. We have gone out to the remote areas of Alaska and have listened to some of their difficulties that they have of trying, especially when it comes to the education realm, because they were having difficulty using their post-9/11 GI Bill. And Congress passed a law and the president signed it into law. Actually, the president signed into law the post 9/11 2.0 program in January of this year, and it's actually in effect October of this year. It'll allow people in remote areas to do distance learning and give them a portion of their monthly housing stipend. You know, the biggest key for our veterans when they return home is that to take full advantage of the benefits that they've earned at the VA and to take full advantage of their education benefits so that they are able to level the playing field so that they're more competitive in the job market.
Ferdy Bowen is Director of Veterans Affairs for the state.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
While Americans celebrated the 4th of July just a few days ago, a smaller group in Anchorage will be enjoying their own Independence Day this Saturday. July 9th marks the official independence of South Sudan from their northern neighbors, and it's been a long time coming. Mading Bol is part of the small but vibrant Sudanese community in Anchorage. As chairman of the Alaska Sudanese Community Church, Bol can speak to the happiness his congregation is feeling.
Everybody is very excited to see this happen, because we've been in war for years, and to see that South is an independent country now, you know, everybody is very happy.
Sudan has been in conflict for the majority of its 55-year history. A peace was brokered between North and South Sudan in 2005, but it wasn't until January of this year that South Sudan, soon to be the Republic of South Sudan, voted to claim their own sovereignty. Border conflicts are ongoing, but Saturday will be a day of celebration for the many Sudanese refugees that have come to the United States over the past few decades. Bol hopes that with peace and independence, refugees can return to South Sudan to help the nation grow. Here in Anchorage, Bol invites the community to be part of the Sudanese independence celebration.
There will be dancing and singing, and they are going to cook some traditional foods.
Bol will also be leading a children's chorus and singing the new national anthem for the Republic of South Sudan. The event takes place on Saturday from 2 to 9 p.m. at Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church in Anchorage. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the crash of Coast Guard Helicopter 6017 on a routine flight between Astoria, Oregon, and its home base at Air Station Sitka. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
A week following the accident, the three airmen who died received full military honors at a standing room only memorial in the air station's hangar. Almost 2,000 people crowded in for the stirring 21-gun salute, taps, and a flyover by helicopters from Air Station Kodiak. Lost in the crash off the coast of La Push, Washington, were Lieutenant Sean Kruger, Petty Officer Adam Hoke, and Petty Officer Brett Banks. A fourth airman, Lieutenant Lance Leone, survived with serious injuries. Lieutenant Commander Doug Cameron had been in charge of Air Station Sitka for only 9 days before the crash, and though he had served in previous assignments with Hoke and Banks and had only just met Kruger, Cameron told mourners that in a small service like the Coast Guard, no one was a stranger.
Our flight boots have worn paint off the deck in front of the same rudder pedals. Our hands have held the same flight controls. And much more importantly, we have both had the privilege of flying with people like Brett Banks and Adam Hoke.
That sentiment was shared by Admiral Robert J. Papp, Commandant of the Coast Guard, who was among the numerous dignitaries at the memorial. He shared his thoughts with reporters after the ceremony.
It's such a small service by comparison to the others that when we do have a loss of any one Coast Guardsman, much less three, it really touches the lives of all of us. So that's why we gather together, why we take the time to do ceremonies like this. I refer to it as the manners of our profession, but it's really a time for us to get together, to celebrate the lives of these great heroes, and then to shore each other up to be able to get through the tragedy.
According to District 17 Operations, the Coast Guard suffered 7 major aviation mishaps in the 2 years prior to the loss of the Sitka helicopter. Since the crash of 6017, however, there have been no major incidents. In a news release, Vice Admiral Brian Salerno says the service has returned to the basics: aviate, navigate, and communicate. He also stressed the importance of battling complacency, managing the rate of change, and mitigating risk. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Board of Directors for the Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Memorial in Juneau has come out in favor of leaving the monument where it is and against building a cruise ship dock in front of it. Last year, the City and Borough Assembly approved a plan to construct 2 new floating berths on Gastineau Channel, one of which would sit in front of the memorial. City officials asked the board to weigh in on whether the shrine should move, and if so, where. The board's Bruce Wyrock says having a cruise ship dock in front of the memorial defeats the purpose of having an unobstructed view of the water.
Having families who lost commercial fishermen be able to spend time at a memorial that is located on the sea is very important to them.
In a letter to CBJ port engineer Gary Gillette last week, the board said it prefers the city not construct a dock in front of the memorial at all. If the dock is built there, the board wants the memorial moved to Marine Park and assurances that nothing will be built on the water in front of it. Gillette says the recommendation will go to the Docks and Harbors Board as well as the city's Parks and Recreation Advisory Committee.
The assembly basically said to work with them to move it to a mutually agreeable location, and I don't think the Harbor Board has any issue with any of the locations mentioned, but since Parks and Rec more or less in charge of Marine Park, they would have to concur, so there will be some sort of review process yet.
And Gillette says the assembly may end up making the final decision. For now, $2 million is included in the dock expansion budget for the purpose of moving the memorial. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Steve Heimel and Heather Arona reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.